Well, last week I talked a little bit about getting to know Jesus better, something that was a challenge to me during my sabbatical. I can't remember who was here last week. Nobody. Everyone's looking at me blankly. Yes, you go. I don't know if you were challenged by that, but I've been challenged, continue to be challenged by just getting to know Jesus better. If you weren't here last week, I mentioned there was a guy called Krish Kandaya, who I heard speaking at Keswick Convention at the beginning of my sabbatical. And he did this just very brief talk, but it was just straight to the point. And he was talking about, he said, you know, you meet people and they get really into their mobile phone and they just talk about their mobile phone and they're just talking about it all the time. And he said, you know, Apple don't send people like that on courses on how to sell their phone, you know, or Samsung or whoever. They just produce a good product and they hook you in for however they do it, and then you get into it and you just start living in it, don't you? I mean, how many people do you see nowadays that are like this, you know? And he said, there's so many people come to me in my church and they say, oh, we need to go on a course or something to help with our evangelism. So we need to be trained on how to be evangelists. And he just said, you just need to get to know Jesus better. You just need to get to know the person of Jesus, and then you will just naturally just start talking about him. And I was challenged by that. So last week, just again recapping, we talked a little bit about Jesus. What does he say to his disciples? He says, to start off with, he says, follow me. That's it. I think sometimes we overcomplicate being a Christian, but that's just the essence of it, isn't it? Follow me. It's an invitation to walk with Jesus. It's an invitation to do the things Jesus does. It's an invitation to live as Jesus lives. There's another verse in Matthew 11 which says, come to me all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So when Jesus says, come to me, if you look in the Greek, it's actually the same word that he uses for follow me. So it's the same call. Come to me, follow me. Come and do what I'm doing. And that idea of taking a yoke. Anyone know what a yoke is now? Do you know what a yoke is? You do. About a yolk. Yeah, I knew you'd say that. Yeah, it is the orange part of an egg. Okay, let's have a vote. Are we going to go for is Jesus talking about the thing there with the cow, put the cows together, or is he talking about put your yellow egg yolk on me? You think it's the egg. Okay. That's because you've been to too many youth groups. I'm afraid to say, I think he's talking about that thing where the cattle are attached together and they have a yoke on them. And the idea is that you're walking in step with one another. So Jesus is saying, I mean, this is amazing, isn't it? This is Jesus, the creator of everything. And he says, come to me, follow me, but we'll walk together. You can learn to walk in step with me. You can learn to follow my patterns and see where I'm going and be sort of joined to me. Or you can have egg all over you. Maybe that's what he was saying. Okay, well, you can, when you have a chance to do a service, Isabel, you can maybe preach that message. Yeah. Okay. The message translation of the same passage, it says, are you tired, worn out, burned out religion? Come to me. Get away with me and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. I love that translation. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. So it's all about getting to know Jesus better. And if we get to know Jesus better, if we walk with him, if we follow him, it will change our lives for the better. It will do. As we read about Jesus, as we learn from him, study his every move, copy him, assimilate him, it will change us for the better. And in actual fact, this is what Jesus does himself. Jesus said, I only do what I see the Father doing. So he in himself, there's something in the Trinity where the Trinity works together by seeing what God is doing, the Father is doing, and following that. So that's the pattern for us to live like the Trinity and to say, okay, I'm going to live like Jesus, I'm going to follow and copy that. Now in the 1990s, that's a time in history for you, and for us, that is a time earlier in our lives. In the 1990s, there was a phrase that became popular, which was it wasn't really a phrase, it was four letters, WWJD. Does anyone remember that? Yes? What would Jesus do? Exactly. And there was little sort of wristband things, a bit like Ella's got around her ankle. They made these things into wristbands or t-shirts, WWJD. And the idea was you need to think, okay, in this situation, rather than doing what I would do, what would Jesus do? And then behave like that. And it's a great idea. It's actually wasn't invented in the 1990s. It goes right back to the Catholic idea of imitating God and following his, they use a Latin Passio Dei, I think you say it, in the imitation of God. You know, that's the Catholic idea of study God and live like him. And that's how we're called to be made, we are made in God's image, and so if we want to live well, we do that. And so that's where this phrase, I think, and ideally it comes from, what would Jesus do? Probably a bit easier to say than the Latin. But I think too often we probably think, I kind of know what I think Jesus would do because I have a cultural idea of who Jesus is. Be that the blonde hair and blue eyed cultural idea, or be that the white British middle class idea, or be that whatever culture we come from idea of who Jesus is. So we kind of assume he will do like our culture does, if you like. Or maybe we would have the idea, I think Jesus would do this because I've seen how my church does it. So for instance, I'm pretty sure that Jesus would worship using four or five songs back to back. And when he broke bread and had communion, he'd probably get us all to stand up in a circle, and we would do exactly what we've done and as we do every week, you know, because that's what my church does. Well, that must be what Jesus does or did. So we have those ideas, and we shape our idea of Jesus on the way we look, way we've been brought up in church. You know, Jesus was a Baptist, obviously. Yeah, or if you're an Anglican, Jesus was an Anglican. You know, or if you're a Catholic, Jesus was a Catholic. That idea. And there's probably, even going deeper than that, there's probably a little part in all of us that assumes we know what Jesus would do because we know what is right. And so Jesus will do what is right. Even if we don't do what is right, we have an idea of what is right, don't we? So I would like this to happen, I would like that to happen. Even if I don't do those things, I know what is right, so I presume that Jesus would do that because Jesus does the right thing. Yeah? But I've been this week, as I've been thinking about this, as I've been listening, as I say, on sabbatical and getting to know Jesus better, when you get to actually know Jesus, he's just a little bit odd. Yeah? When you actually start to read and study and walk with him, he doesn't necessarily do the right thing always. In terms of what you would expect him to do, he doesn't do things the way our church does it. He doesn't necessarily do things the way our culture does things. He says some odd things. He does some pretty off-the-wall things. I mean, they're off-the-wall to us, and they're odd to us. But that's, if you actually look at Jesus, that's what he's like. And if we want to get to know Jesus, there should be something about him, his presence in our life, that is genuinely a little bit disturbing. A little bit unsettling. Because we're not 100% like him, and he's not 100% like us. In fact, he's 100% holy and 100% God. And so there's something, when he's in our life and when we're yoked together with him, where we should be slightly unsettled, slightly disturbed. I can't remember, I should have looked it up. There's a prayer, isn't there? Disturb me, Lord. I can't remember how he said that. But, anyway, you can look that one up. So let me just give you a few examples. I was thinking about this. You know, there was a man in John chapter 9, there's a man who is born blind. Okay? And he comes to Jesus. And so what would Jesus do? Here's the scenario. There's a man, he's blind, he can't see. So what would Jesus do? Let's think about it. Oh, you've given the game away. Yeah, I know you know that. But that's the odd thing, isn't it? Because you would just assume that Jesus would heal him usually. You know, let's bring somebody who's blind and they would heal him, or maybe and or forgive him, because often Jesus then pronounced forgiveness as well as the healing. But like Isabel says, who's obviously Sunday school's better than I realised. You know, they teach them well there. So what did actually Jesus do? He didn't just get mud, actually. He was got some dirt from the ground, spat in it, you know. You know. Well, exactly. This is the thing. This is what he did. Well, you think so? Yeah. You know, you've been with, you know, that's what guys do. He gets spit, he gets mud, and he makes it into some kind of muddy paste. Now, and also think about this, and we've got some friends whose boys were born with severe eye issues, and their eyes were very sensitive. They couldn't see very well as it was, but there was a time when there was some building work going on in one of their houses they live, many houses, and dust got into one of the boys' eyes, and it actually degraded their eyesight by, say, 10% or something. It was a really serious issue, you know, because if you think about it, where's one of the most sensitive parts of your body is your eye, right? Yeah? And, you know, so what does Jesus do? He gets this unclean stuff off the ground, gets some snotty saliva and spits it into it, which is probably full of germs, puts it in his eye. I mean, that's just odd. We read it, yeah, Jesus put mud in his eye. But this is just weird. It's disturbing. Because if the guy wasn't fully blind to start with, he certainly would be now, you know. So either that or healed. And that's the way Jesus did it. Not our way, not clean and clinical, and not detached and kind of, okay, be healed, don't even get involved, don't touch. But that's the way Jesus did it. I don't know whether I'd recommend that the next person you see who's blind or partially blind, and they say, can you pray for me? You go, yeah, all right. And you kind of scoop up something off the ground and do that his way. But all I'm saying is, Jesus' way is not necessarily the way we'd expect. There was the time he was in the boat. Now, those boats that the fishermen use, I looked up some pictures because, of course, the pictures that we have on the internet are exactly the same as the ones that Jesus would have been in the boat. But then they're not. I mean, Ella and I, we've started watching this program she likes called Saving Lives at Sea. I don't know if you've seen this. And it's about the lifeboats, people that go out to save people at sea. And some of the conditions at sea are just crazy, you know. There's some of the things they go out in. And you see, and of course they've got a modern lifeboat. Well, they go out in a dinghy sometimes, but they've got this massive big ship thing with cabins and all that kind of modern stuff on it. And, you know, you imagine that if you're going to have a sleep, you would be asleep in a cabin at the bottom somewhere with the windows and the doors shut. But you look at the idea of those fishing boats in those days, they're probably about from me to Keith, maybe me to Chris, possibly, I don't know. They're not that big. They're open topped. They've kind of just got sides, a sail, somewhere to put your fish, somewhere to cast your net over. That's it. You know, I mean, they weren't there to do like holiday pleasure cruises or something. So when Jesus is asleep in the boat, he's just kind of just like sitting where Keith is, or lying where Keith is, and that's it. I mean, you can prod him and poke him. You probably have to step over him to get to Chris, you know. And then there was a storm. And so if you watch this Saving Lives at Sea, you see the water is going like this, and it's tipping over, and there's probably the boat's filling up. And Jesus is asleep, so no doubt he's rocking around. Anybody, I mean, Louise can tell you, she's not great. I'm not great on boats. Like, I wouldn't be great on a boat going up and down like this, you know. That would wake you up. It would throw you about a bit. You'd get bumped around. There'd probably be water splashing on him. There's probably water. He's probably lying in water, I'm guessing. What would Jesus do? Well, he'd calm the storm. And yes, he does calm the storm, and that is remarkable. But what is disturbing to me is the fact that he didn't wake up in the first place. Yeah? I mean, some people are deep sleepers, you know, and you give him a prod a few times, but there's water sloshing on his face, the things getting thrown around, and, you know, probably the disciples are panicking and shouting, there's the noise of the whole thing, and he didn't wake up. Odd, strange, disturbing. So if I was the disciples and I would look back at it and think, wow, he calmed the storm. That was amazing. That did save our lives. But it took us ages to wake him up. Why is that? Why is that? It's disturbing. When Jesus is in our lives, it's a bit... Well, it's disturbing. Keith got me onto one last week, actually. At the end of last week's service, he said, oh, there's a verse, isn't there, where some men come to Jesus, and they say, sir, we would like to see Jesus. And we looked up the verse in John chapter 12. And I looked it up, and the story is this. There's some Greeks, Greeks and Jews didn't really mix in those days, but they come and they want to see Jesus, and that's the phrase they use. So they come to Philip, one of the disciples, and they say, sir, we would like to see Jesus. Philip, being really bold, goes to Andrew and says, there's some guys here and they want to see Jesus. They're Greeks. So Andrew, being really bold, takes Philip with him to go to Jesus and says, we've got these guys here and they'd like to see you. So what would we expect Jesus to say in that situation? Yes, okay. All right, thank you. I'm glad you're here, Isabel. You've enlivened the audience input here by 100%. Sometimes I think they fall asleep. Maybe. So we would like to think that Jesus is the kind of guy that would go, yeah, everybody, come to me, wouldn't we? We think we know Jesus. Or if you you know some of your Bible stories, there's that time, isn't there, where that woman comes to Jesus who wasn't a Jew, and Jesus says to her, quite harshly it seems, it's not right for me to take the children's food and give it to the dogs. Oh, yeah. Ah, you didn't do that one in Sunday school. Yeah, that's not the kind of Sunday. You're going up a level now. And so he kind of says, no, sorry, it's not your time. It's not for you now. So those are two things that what would Jesus do? But I tell you, this is what Jesus says. So here, remember the story. So there's a man, men, they come to Philip. Philip then goes to Andrew. Andrew and Philip then go to Jesus, and they say, there's some guys here, they want to see you. And then Jesus replies and says this. Jesus replied, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Anyone who loves their life will lose it. While anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. My soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. The crowd that was there heard it and said it thundered. Others said an angel had spoken. Jesus said, this voice was for your benefit, not for mine. Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Now, I don't know what these Greeks were expecting. That's a weird sort of like thing, isn't it? That's not a kind of, yes, come to me, or no, don't come to me. He just kind of goes off on one. I don't know about you, but I find that a little bit... I imagine sort of Philip and Andrew kind of turning around to these Greeks and kind of going, I'm not quite sure what you're expecting, but sorry, he's having a funny day, you know? This is a bit strange. A bit odd. You know, it's not, you know, we work on our evangelistic strategies and we think we should, you know, let's be friendly to the people come in and make the message understandable and easy to get your head around, and we'll use language that people understand. And Jesus starts talking about unless the seed falls to the ground and dies. And where's he going with this? The only thing, I mean, thanks Keith for pushing me in this direction, but I've spent a whole week looking at this passage thinking, what was he talking about? Why did he say all this? The only thing I can get from it, right at the end he says, I will draw all people to myself. And I think it does come back to what Isabel said. Whilst these men thought they were coming to see Jesus, Jesus says, I will gather all people to me. But he goes about it in a rather strange way. To us, strange to us, but that's the whole point. There's a lot of these. How long have you got? Did you know there's that time when Jesus says to the disciples, who do they say I am? And they say, oh, some people are saying you're a prophet, some people are saying you're Elijah, da da da. And he turns to Peter and he says to Peter, who do you say I am? And Peter says, well, you're Christ, you're the Messiah. And Jesus congratulates him and says, yes, you've got it, Peter. And on this rock, and he kind of renames Simon being Peter, I will build my church. And you can imagine Peter. I mean, let's be honest. If you were Peter, you'd be like, finally, I've got something right, you know. Yeah, I've got it. You know, and you're kind of walking away thinking, I mean, does anyone commend you for anything? You do feel slightly good about yourself, don't you? So Peter's probably thinking, yeah. Not 10 verses later, Jesus is talking about his death again. You see, he's talking about his death a lot again, which is disturbing. He says, you know, something along the lines of, you know, I need to die. And Peter says, oh, no. That's not going to happen. And what does Jesus say? Get behind me, Satan. This happens within 10 verses in the story. And so you've got, this is disturbing. Well, on the one hand, you're thinking, yeah, Jesus thinks I'm the bee's knees. And then the next thing, he's calling me Satan. Yeah? Now, sometimes, I mean, that challenges our once saved, always saved kind of Calvinistic way of looking at things. I think that should unsettle us, because sometimes maybe we're too relaxed in thinking, yeah, faultless I stand before the throne. I believe that, okay? I do believe that. Faultless I stand before the throne. We sang it. I wanted to sing it a few times this morning to reinforce that. But at the same time, I am in the hands of the Lord Almighty. I am in the hands of only His grace. And there are times where we have to just sort of humbly say, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, and I become like, you know, Peter here just got it completely wrong, and Jesus kind of, his words were so stark that it made him just think, oh, okay, the call of Satan is no small thing. And you see what I'm saying? There's that kind of tension between us being completely confident in God, but at the same time knowing that we have to be completely confident in God, because otherwise if we're confident in us, it's not about me being the beaten. It's about His growth. Unsettling. It's an unsettling thing. Last one. You probably know this one. You know, Lazarus got sick. You remember Lazarus? So Jesus gets, he wasn't with Lazarus at the time. Jesus gets a message. Lazarus is sick. What would Jesus do? Go and heal him. You would assume. You read the other stories, that's what Jesus does. He's a big into healing, you know. Whether he does it with mud or whatever, however he does it, he's into healing. So what would Jesus do? He'd probably run there and go and heal him. In fact, there is that instance, doesn't he, where is it centurion's daughter, you know, come, my daughter's sick. So yeah, I'll come. I'm coming. I'm on my way. What does Jesus do? What does he actually do? He waits for 2 days. Yes. Well, you know, have you been around those kind of people that, you know, there are people that you know you need to be somewhere, and they decide that they want that extra coffee in the service station. I mean, I've been with musicians like this, and you think, we've got to get to the gig on time, and they decide, oh, we'll just have a coffee, or we'll, you know, just have, I'm a bit hungry, yeah, if we don't make this gig, you won't get paid, you won't better feed yourself, so let's just get going, you know. There are some people that just like to take their time. Or they seem to have the ultimate faith in the M25 a lot more than I have faith in the M25, and think, well, you can just, you know. And I imagine the disciples thinking, oh, Lazarus is sick. Maybe we should get going. Maybe we should just go now. But Jesus waits for 2 days. Now, why did he wait for 2 days? I think you're right, Sheila, just to make sure he's properly dead by the time they arrived, you know. And it wasn't, you know, it's another thing that Michael Card, who's speaking about Jesus, one of the things that stops us getting to know Jesus is that 2,000 years is a long, long time. And actually we forget they didn't have mobile phones or even any form of communication that was anywhere near quick. So when somebody comes and says Lazarus is dead, is ill, that probably possibly took a day for that message to arrive and another day for Jesus to get there before even anything happened. So, yeah. And the thing is, by the time he gets there, Lazarus is properly dead. He's been dead for 4 days. So, yeah. And the thing is, also within that, he says to the disciples, I need to go to Judea. And the disciples say to him, that's where they want to kill you. Why would you want to go to Judea? That's like going, there's a war going on over there, and there's people wanting, you're the enemy. Let's go straight into it. This is crazy. But this is Jesus, and it's not comfortable sometimes. And so I'd ask you the question, when was the last time Jesus challenged or changed you or unsettled you in some way, caused you to rethink the way you think or behave or speak? And if it was a long time ago, can I suggest that maybe you need to get to know him a little better and just be challenged by some of these things and ways that he does? If you can't remember, just I challenge you to consider following him a little closer. And for us, you know, we talked about last week, Jesus said to the fishermen, the disciples, I will make you fishers of men. And I think part of that is him saying, I'm going to make you not completely different, but the best version of you that you can be. They were fishermen, but I'm going to take that further. I'm going to make you fishers of men. And for us to grow into the best version we can be, we need to live with that slightly unsettling, slightly disturbing presence of Jesus in our lives. And if we truly get to know him better, it will change us for the better. And for this church to grow, there needs to be that unsettling presence of Jesus in our congregation so that we are transformed into being the best version of kings that kings can be. Because he isn't quite like us. I'm going to finish with a little reading from the Chronicles of Narnia. Who's read the Chronicles of Narnia? If you haven't read them, you may think these are children's stories. We used to start listening to them in the car and on long journeys. And I now almost want to take a detour just to make sure we finish these. They're just amazing. The Lion and the Witch of the Wardrobe, brilliant. So this is, if you don't know this story, so there's a character called Aslan who's the sort of Jesus character. And there's some children in the Lion and the Witch of the Wardrobe who are called Lucy, Susan, Peter, and Edmund. Thank you. And they meet all these different characters and creatures in this other world through the wardrobe called Narnia. And they've come across these creatures, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who are describing Aslan, the Jesus character, to them. And this is what how the conversation goes. Is he a man? Asked Lucy. Aslan, a man? Said the Beaver sternly. Certainly not. I tell you, he is the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who is the king of the beasts? Aslan is a lion. The lion. The great lion. Ooh, said Susan. I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, my dearie, and no mistake, said Mrs. Beaver. If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they are either braver than most or just silly. Then he isn't safe, said Lucy. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he is good. He's the king, I tell you. The image there is of Aslan the king, who's a lion, who isn't safe. And what lion is safe? But he is good, and he is the king. And so the challenge today is to get to know Jesus better. It will change you for the better. He is disturbing, but he is Lord, and he is good. He doesn't offer stability, but he does offer peace, so that you can sleep safe through the storm. He's not safe, but he is trustworthy. He doesn't give all the right answers, but he is the truth. He doesn't follow our agenda, but he will see us to the end. He is altogether other. He's altogether different. Yet he desires for us to walk yoked with him, in step with him, and to learn his step. So, let's get to know Aslan better. Let's get to know Jesus better. Let's pray. Jesus, particularly as we again come towards the time of Christmas, we thank you that you came to this world to show yourself to us, to reveal yourself to us, that we may know God in flesh and blood through Jesus Christ. In Jesus is the fullness of God. In Jesus is the fullness of the image of God. And we thank you that we have seen you and we can see you. But Lord, forgive us where we have made you into something that you aren't, or maybe followed ideas of who you are based on our ideas. And enable us to read the Gospels again afresh and get to know you and be challenged and be unsettled and be disturbed in the best possible way as we get to know you, that you may change us and transform us into the best versions of us that we can be. Teach us your ways. Help us as we are yoked together with you to walk in your ways. Disturb us, O Lord. Thank you. Amen.